Morning. I'm Jerry Hyman. I'm president of the HILS program on governance here at CSIS, and on behalf of the HILS program, but also on behalf of the Global Strategies Initiative with the gentleman that's walking behind right over there, also at CSIS, we are very pleased to co-sponsor this event. Just a moment, if I could, of a personal story. I had a chance about, 5 years ago or so, to be in southern Sudan in the Upper Nile. A more desolate environment, I think it would be perhaps hard to find, except perhaps in the middle of the Sahara itself. Very desiccated, very difficult environment. And we went around from village to village in the Upper Nile, every day a different place. I'm an anthropologist by training, so we got to meet the Nuer and the Dinka and the Shilluk. If you're ever any anthropologist in here, that's where you go when you die. You go to heaven and you interview the Nuer and the Dinka and the Shilluk, and you find out whether all these people that wrote these books back in the 30s were really right or not. And got a chance to meet the Shilluk king of all people, who turns out to have been a banker from Basel, but now... Now is living in a quote palace of mud huts in the middle of the Upper Nile, wearing at least for in our occasion a leopard skin thing and not a suit and a tie for sure. Anyway, we went from one of these villages to the next, and each day we had to fly in an airplane that landed on a mud strip. And every day they brought us two bottles this size of water. It's 120 degrees at the time, and by the time the second day came around, I was basically not eating anymore because I didn't feel I had enough juices to digest the food, let alone was I not hungry. It went around for about a week, and I really didn't have any problem with not eating for the week. But I can tell you that you may read all you like about water, but until you have been in a place like that, where you recognize that if that plane doesn't come the next day, you have one of two choices. You're either going to get dehydrated and possibly die, or you're going to drink the well water, in which case you're going to get hugely sick and may die also. And so for the first time, I really recognized in an emotional, not just intellectual way, the critical dimension of water and why people go to war for water and why we find all of these conflicts. So the idea of corruption in the water sector, the theft of water, which is, as they say, the new oil, I think we will find soon enough, is a major, major source of problems for our world. We already see it in Atlanta. Last summer, there was, I don't know about a war, but it was almost the hostilities between the five states around Atlanta about who was going to get water, Colorado River water, California, all kinds of places in our own country that have water problems, and not to say nothing of the Nile and the Jordan and the Amazon and the Sahel and the Aral Sea and so forth. So this particular report is particularly helpful to us to say that 10 to 30%, as some of the report suggests, of water is siphoned off through corruption. It's just a travesty, really, I think, and will result in some really serious problems, because what we're talking about here is survival, not just a matter of how many bribes do you pay for a bed or a television. This is much more serious stuff. So we are very grateful on behalf of GSI and the HILS program to co-sponsor, and we thank TI for letting us do so. Where's Nancy?
Here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, and thanks to CSIS for co-hosting this launch today. We appreciate the good work and cooperation we've had with the HILS program and look forward to working with the Global Strategy Institute on water going forward. It's a pleasure for me as the head of the U.S. chapter of Transparency International to welcome all of you, many friends and new faces here today, as well as to thank our panelists for joining us for what is going to be, I think, a really terrific discussion. I'm also here as a member of TI's Board of Directors to extend Huguette Labelle's deepest regrets for not being able to join us today. She had wanted to share with you her deep conviction that this year's report focusing on water is of vital importance. I think our speakers will demonstrate this more fully, but I'd like to simply note that the decision we made to focus on water this year was based on the fact that it's a uniquely important resource, that it's plagued by corruption, that there's insufficient attention and awareness and understanding of how it works, and as we'll hear from our panelists, that there are actually ways to reduce it. So that's the good news. To give you a sense of the importance of the issue, I think I just shut off somebody's presentation here. Sorry. But on a more serious note, to give you a sense of the importance of this issue, some statistics that I found really stunning. More than 1 billion people lack access to safe drinking water, and 40% of the world's population would live without adequate sanitation. In fact, estimates are that 80% of health problems in the developing world are estimated to result from inadequate access to safe water, as are the deaths of almost 2 million children every year. And as we look to the future, the problem becomes even more urgent with water scarcity, population growth, global food shortages, climate change, and more water-intensive industries, so that as we look ahead to 2025, we look at more countries under stress in this area. The impact of corruption is and will be felt most acutely in the developing world, but as the report illustrates, it also hits those of us living in the industrialized countries. It hits across sectors in all segments, as we'll hear from our panelists, including the management of water resources, sanitation, irrigation, and hydropower. I thought it was interesting that while it takes the usual forms that we think about in terms of corruption, including bribery, bid rigging, collusion, and so forth, it's the impact that is most important, because it's immediate and damaging to health, to food safety and security, environmental sustainability, and even in many countries, political stability. Fortunately, as I mentioned, there are the report does demonstrate there are things we can do, and we hope that this report will stimulate the kind of collective action across borders with all of the stakeholders engaged in finding a way forward. And I think it's useful that our panel represents different stakeholders who can give us a sense of what each group can be doing to move this agenda forward. Before turning the mic over to my colleague, Dieter Zinbauer, who's the editor of this year's report, I just want to mention another report the TI put out just yesterday, which is the progress report on compliance with the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention. This is the fourth annual report the TI chapters have put together, looking at the extent to which our governments are enforcing laws prohibiting foreign bribery. And I thought it was a very useful complement to the water report that we're talking about today, because if we don't stem foreign bribes in the water sector, we will remain plagued by the same kinds of problems in all the areas I've mentioned. The conclusion of the report is that while there has been some progress, countries like Germany and France are joining the United States in terms of bringing substantial numbers of cases, otherwise the picture is fairly dismal. So we're hopeful that that report, as well as this report, will achieve their purpose, which is to bring people like you together to the table to work with us to take these initiatives forward. I should mention that there are TI chapters like ours in over 100 countries around the world. We work with government, with international organizations, and the private sector. So for those of you who are working in the water sector who are not already working with TI, we would look forward to working with you in the future. With that, let me say thank you very much for coming today. And Dieter, the mic is yours.
Thank you, Nancy. Hello, good morning, everyone. My name is Dieter Zinbauer. I'm the chief editor of the Global Corruption Report. And I would like to join Nancy, first of all, in thanking the organizers, CSIS, to give us this great opportunity to present the findings of what has been an 18-month effort to really try to, in detail, explore corruption in the water sector. Let me give you a quick introduction to what the Global Corruption Report actually is. It's our flagship publication. TI has put out this report since 2001. Every year we invite a group of experts, practitioners, and activists to explore one topic with specific relevance to corruption. And so far we have covered issues such as political corruption, corruption in health, last year corruption in the judiciary, and this year corruption in the water sector. And we have chosen the topic of corruption in the water sector, as Nancy also mentioned, for one very simple reason. Perhaps in no other sector is the impact of corruption so profoundly, perniciously, and directly related to the lives and livelihoods of billions of people around the world. Now, it's impossible to do justice to a 350-page report in 10 minutes, and we have a very distinguished panel of experts with us today who are a lot better positioned than I am to really go into the details with you. So I really confine myself to really just throwing out four or five of the key takeaway messages of the report. Number one, corruption is, as the report clearly shows in case study after case study, a root cause and a catalyst of the global water crisis. Corruption takes many forms in the water sector across the water value chain. It starts with manipulation of policy design and technology choice in the water sector. It includes the embezzlement of funds and budgets. It also includes fraud, kickbacks, bid rigging, collusion in the tendering and procurement process. And it also, of course, involves extortion, bribery in the operations and repair works related to water infrastructures. The report also clearly shows, and I really invite you to dig deeper into it. We have complimentary copies outside. Take one home. The report really clearly shows that corruption plagues all subsectors of the water sector, from water resources management, which includes the principal fundamental decisions about water allocation, water preservation, to drinking water and sanitation, a key sector for human health and development, to irrigation in agriculture, and also extends to the hydropower sector. The report also provides very compelling evidence that this is a phenomenon that is not confined to developing countries. We do have case studies in the report that clearly show that it also is an issue for industrialized countries. And perhaps most importantly, the report shows, and most sadly the report shows, that it is the poor, it is women, girls, and its marginalized communities that suffer most from corruption in the water sector. Let me just flesh this out with one quick example. We have referenced in the report a very interesting case study from India, where someone did a very comprehensive case study with stakeholder interviews from all sides and has tried to capture corruption in the water sector and has tried to quantify like what ballpark levels we are actually talking about. So the study finds that bribes in the contract initiation phase like add up to about 6% of contract value. Kickbacks during the construction period add another 11% to this. Collusion and bid rigging in the tendering phase inflate the cost by another up to 15%. And the loss that comes about, the estimated loss through substandard work that is done because of corruption adds up to another 15%. Now, adding this up, we end up with a very staggering sum. The corruption burden on providing water in India adds up to between 25 and 45% of the costs. And if you do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation and put this in context with the money that is needed to achieve the Millennium Development Goals in water and sanitation, you add up with a corruption-imposed burden that raises the costs for achieving the MDGs in water and sanitation by almost $50 billion. Finding number two, despite its importance, corruption is still surprisingly absent from the water policy debate. The water crisis is usually described as a crisis of governance that requires more awareness, more national action plans, more international coordination, and more money. Corruption very rarely features in those prescriptions. To again give you an example, the UNDP 2006 Human Development Report, with a focus on water, mentions the word corruption only 10 times in about 400 pages. The 2007 UNDP Human Development Report on Climate Change, which has a very important dimension on water and water policies, does not mention corruption at all. The UNEP Global Environmental Outlook, the flagship publication from UNEP for 2007, also important dimension on water, mentions corruption only once. That is a deplorable situation, and we hope to come into this gap with our report and start pushing this further up the policy agenda. Finding number three, why is the water sector so vulnerable to corruption? Basically, at least five principal reasons can extract it from the analysis that the report provides. Number one, the water sector faces an extremely fragmented regulatory landscape. Water is about health, it's about environment, it's about economic development, it's about infrastructure, agriculture, and so on. And it has an international dimension. It is administered at local, regional, and national level, so you have an incredibly fragmented mix of oversight and diffused accountabilities that leaves large interstices for corruption. Secondly, many water infrastructure projects, be it in irrigation, be it in hydropower, be it in water and sanitation or water resources management, are highly complex, difficult to standardize, and very expensive undertakings. So in a nutshell, building water infrastructures is a procurement and tendering nightmare. It is very difficult to do this in a standard procurement process. Thirdly, also very importantly, on the political economy side, the people, the stakeholders that suffer most from corruption are the least likely to be able to demand accountability. It's the poor, it's very often indigenous communities, it is future generations, and it is the environment that also suffers from that. Fourth, and that's related to the political environment, the action in the water sector is more and more moving to markets and to countries that have high corruption environments. 9 out of 10 top growth water markets are in countries that, for example, our Corruption Perception Index classifies as high-risk countries. And lastly, we all know about increasing local water scarcities. If things continue the way they go now, like we'll end up with about 3 billion people living in water-stressed countries, in water-stressed regions by 2025, and increasing competition for water raises the stakes and raises the premium for corruption. And add to this climate change, which further aggravates water scarcities, and you can see the scope of the problem. So summing this up, the water sector is very vulnerable to corruption, and I think no one has more presciently and succinctly summarized that then the late comedian W.C. Fields, who said famously, "You cannot trust water, even a straight stick turns crooked in it." Now this all sounds rather gloomy, but belief is nigh. The report presents a very wide range of promising examples of how, at the local level, with customized initiatives, progress can be made. There is no magic bullet, of course, but there are a lot of examples that have transcended the idea stage, have actually been implemented, and have shown proven results in the sector. Roughly, and this is my last point here, I try to cluster those initiatives that come out of the different chapters in four groups. One is related to a transparency initiative for the entire sector. Transparency, more transparency with regard to financial flows, with regard to budgets, with regard to expenditures, but transparency also on the outcome and output side with regard to a stronger and a more widespread adoption of performance indicators. To give you one example from Bangalore, where our citizen report cards that for the first time gave citizens the opportunity to rate their public utilities and register their satisfaction with public utilities. This instrument has been used since 1994 and now been replicated in more than 20 countries around the world. And this has really produced a very effective pressure on the local government to raise the standards of the water utility. Second group has to do with accountability. institutional reform of water utilities has in some instances proven very successful. Water utilities have been parceled out from the general administration, have been incorporated separately with their own budgets, with their own oversight, and this has led to markedly improved performance, for example, in Dakar, Senegal, or in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. And we also, in the context of accountability, seeing a situation where the stepping up of regulatory oversight could make a big difference. The water sector is lagging behind in comparison with other utilities in terms of the existence and the capacities of regulatory enforcement agencies in the countries around the world. The third cluster of remedies has to do with participation. This is really also like a red line through the report. Participation in irrigation management, participation in budgeting, in expenditure tracking, participation even in the tendering process, where, for example, in Mexico, a tendering process for a hydropower dam involved a so-called testigo social, a social witness, an independent observer that has participated in the process, and the eventual tender bid was 8.5% cheaper than what would have been expected previously, according to previous trends in that area. Final area, collective action. It's important to remember that corruption is fueled by a breakdown of trust that other stakeholders are playing by the rules, creating a collective action problem there. So we need templates that allow stakeholders to make credible commitments that they will stick to anti-corruption and compliance policies in the sector. TI, for example, has sponsored initiatives in Colombia and Argentina, so-called sectoral agreements, where pipe manufacturers, the largest pipe manufacturers in the water sector, came together and made an anti-corruption pledge to foster the trust that everyone is playing by the rules and that accountability is strengthened that way. So to wrap up, taking action in the water sector is against corruption is a moral imperative. It is very urgent, and as hopefully my last examples have shown a little bit, it is also feasible. And there is no excuse for not taking action now. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My job today is to work with this distinguished panel here and try to make sure everybody in the room mixes this up. We want to have a conversation that goes to every aspect of this report that we can think of. And we want it to be a conversation. We want you to jump in at any point when you get any kind of bright idea. Everybody here is ready for that. They all have depth of knowledge from years and years of working in the water field. So just really, let's all mix it up as much as we can. Just keep the questions short and to the point. If there are speeches to be made, we'll let the panel do that. The panelists are engineers, lawyers, bankers, and economists. As I said before, they know everything there is to know about water. Håkan Trop is an economist from Sweden. He's the chairman of Water Integrity Network. Peter Harald is from the World Bank. Letitia Obeng is originally from Ghana. She's been a long-time World Bank person, and she's global. She's chairwoman of Global Water Partnership. Roberto Di Michele is with the Inter-American Development Bank, and we have Jean-Michel Devernay, an executive of France's largest hydroelectric company. He's an engineer. Now, I'm at the University of Miami. We're crazy about water there. We're surrounded by water, but we're serious about fresh water. A lot of our research projects deal with that. I was at the New York Times for a long time, and as a result, I think, of covering a lot of hurricanes, I got more and more interested in the environment, and so here I am. I'd like each of the panelists just to tell you a little bit about what they're doing at the moment, and then we'll jump into the questions. And if you could start off, Håkan.
Thanks a lot. I'm very pleased to be here. My name is Håkan Tropp. I'm the chairman for the Water Integrity Network and the WIN, as we call it, Water Integrity Network. We have been co-producing this year's Global Corruption Report. I'm based at something called Stockholm International Water Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, and where I work predominantly with something called UNDP Water Governance Facility, which is an initiative to support water reform in developing countries, providing policy advice, policy support, also advocating improved governance in water. Thank you.
Yeah, and here's Peter.
Thank you. I'm Peter Harold. I'm Director of Operations Services, as we call it, at the World Bank. One of my particular responsibilities is to oversee the implementation of the World Bank's governance and anti-corruption strategy, which causes me to have a lot of dealings with Transparency International, which is a great pleasure. Prior to doing this job, I spent about 13 years in various World Bank offices, ensuring, I hope, decent funding of a significant number of water operations. Thank you.
And here comes Leticia.
Great. First of all, I'd like to say congratulations to TI for this amazing report that is going to, I think, become a Bible for people working in the water sector as we go forward. So congratulations to them. I think we should give them a big hand. Okay, that's my first sentence. Now I've got my second sentence, right?
We're all trained to be brief here.
The Global Water Partnership, I don't know how many people know what it is, but we are also based in Sweden. Our secretariat is in Sweden. And basically our job is to support countries in the sustainable management of water resources. I'll put it that way.
All right, Roberto.
Thank you. Roberto Michele, Senior Policy Advisor at the Office of Institutional Integrity at the Inter-American Development Bank. The function of my office is twofold. We investigate allegations of fraud and corruption and corruption in the activities that the bank finances. And we also, particularly my side of the office, deals with the preventive measures on the lessons learned from the cases that we investigate. So we channel these lessons into our operational cycle and prevent things from happening again.
Jean-Michel.
I'm Jean-Michel de Vernet. I work for Electricité de France, EDF, which is a large power company, which is in fact an international group and not only a French company, as the name might say. I'm managing a group of approximately 700 people who constitute the resources of EDF in terms of hydro engineering for projects in France and international projects as well. And I'm also a vice president of the IHA, the International Hydropower Association. The IHA's mission is to progress and to advance sustainable hydropower, and it is committed to work with other stakeholders to develop and implement good practices in hydropower for planning, development, and operation of hydro projects.
Thank you. Thank you. So that's our team. This report is the first concentrated study of corruption in water. I think, as Leticia says, it might turn out to be a Bible as we move along here. It covers all the chapters that that Transparency International could think of anyway. Pretty, very impressive. We all know about corruption. We all know about water problems, but we don't often put them together, and that's what we're doing here today. First, we're going to define what we're talking about. And Leticia, if you could please tell us about the range of corruption. Is this a high-level problem, a low-level problem? What is the sweep of corruption in water? Sorry.
I think the simplest way to answer that is that it's high level, it's low level, it's mid level. You can find corruption in all aspects of water and the water sector and water management, whether it's a small farmer who manages to get extra water for his or her farm, to major corporations that through collusion or bid rigging end up getting a big contract for a dam. It can be all aspects and at different levels.
And Håkan, I think you know something about it at grassroots level.
Yeah, I think to most of us.
Sorry to interrupt, but not exactly the impact, but just what do you see at the grassroots?
Yeah, I think to most of us, myself, for example, living in a country like Sweden, and corruption occurs there as well, but it's not something that is felt in our daily lives. But really, if you go to slums in developing countries, for example, it's a matter of life and death for people. And that you will have situations where people already today in slums are not connected to municipal water supply, for example. They're not a part of the municipal network. So they have to rely on informal water vendors. They have to perhaps pay 20-25% of their daily income just for water resources, for example. In case they are having chances of getting connected to water, and if they could afford it, they are also many times asked to pay speed money or T money or whatever it's called. Those people are already very poor, and they have very great difficulties in raising funds. So in that sense, corruption can effectively block people from accessing safe water.
Peter, at the bank, are you seeing corruption across the board? Or are you dealing with it mostly at a high level? Talk about that.
Well, we try to deal with it at all levels, but Hakan has just talked eloquently about what we see at the what you can see at the low level. We see big problems at the high level, and really for two or three main reasons. Dieter mentioned one. Projects are often very large. A large hydropower project runs into the billions of dollars. They are extremely complex. There was, when I was a director in Ghana, we were managing preparing for a water project. The tender document was 250 pages long.
What was what size money were you talking
this
about?
This was about a $600 million project, which for Ghana was huge. 250 pages long. And at the end of the day, only three companies, Jean-Michel, if you don't mind me saying, all of them French, only three companies were able to get through this qualification process.
Yeah.
And so you have a complexity. You have limited supply, often controlled by the state, and you very often have a rather limited number of qualified participants in the process. And all of this is a recipe for a situation where corruption can take place.
I'll bet Roberto's seen some of this and might talk about a little of it. And then we'll come back and hear more about some of the cases you've seen, Peter. Michael?
Let me add to that I think the report does a terrific job in connecting that level of corruption with a small bribe paid by a person in a shantytown to get connected. This is the report brings complexity into something that is understandable and can become operational. I think that's a great contribution from this document.
Can the bank make any headway at that level?
At both levels. On the one hand, both banks have their investigative mechanisms, and whenever we find evidence of fraud and corruption in our operations, we proceed with investigations and sanctions. Yeah. But I think also both banks particularly are interested not in the sanctioning process but in the preventive process, how our policies can be improved, how we can deliver better services through our clients and eventually serve the people of the countries that we are financing. And again, I think we shouldn't lose track of another fact that the report brings into light, and that is you can break this down into many pieces, and therefore I think we should avoid the temptation of thinking, as it was said originally at the presentation, that there's a single magic bullet here. Mm-hmm. The other big problem...
In fact, there is no single
there,
magic
there bullet. There is none. Yeah. I think the other issue that comes also very clearly from the report is you can tackle this from the procurement side, you can tackle this from the delivery of public services, you can tackle this from the extractive industry side, from the environmental side.
Yeah.
So the complexity is huge, and I think we should avoid the temptation of thinking that we're going to walk lightly into this and think we're going to solve this.
So we'll get to solutions pretty soon, but Jean-Michel is going to tell us about his experience as an executive in hydroelectricity and projects he's seen, and you know, what is the corruption issue there?
I can only concur with what has been said already, which in hydropower projects, I mean, they are vulnerable, unfortunately, to corruption at all stages of the project, and basically at all levels, starting with a very high level of strategic and policy making when the decision is taken to go ahead for developing hydropower potential. Has it been properly assessed against other options, or is it driven by vested interests? And it goes down all the way. A lot of money is involved in the construction of those projects, so corruption can occur at the stage of procurement and also administration of the construction contracts, which can have detrimental effects, as we'll discuss later on. But all the way also down to the grassroots level, because those large projects also have social and environmental programs associated to it, and that is likely also to be subject to corruption.
So a little about the impact. Now remember, if you could think of anything, step up to it. Anything, you know, I only have a small brain and only come up with a few questions, so I'm sure that there's one right there.
Yeah, I'm sorry to pop in. I'm the manager of the Water Integrity Network. It's a network that is building
up quickly. My name is Teun Bastemeyer. I'm Dutch, but I live in Berlin. There's one question I would like to put to everybody in your in the panel. In the WIN, we are building up that network, and we're asking members soon to sign a code of conduct. And that talks also about what will you do as members of a water integrity network if you find that your staff, or within your organization, your staff is acting against the principles of transparency, honesty, promoting corruption for personal gain, basically.
The question is, what would each of them do
in your organizations?
How would you respond to a discovery of corruption? Yeah. Okay, anybody? Free for all? Peter?
I have one of my board members here, so I have to, I have to respond. We have absolutely zero tolerance for that. Zero tolerance for corruption within our staff. And any staff member so discovered would be dismissed instantly.
So, anybody else want to have a shot at that?
We have the same principle where I'm working. But then I would say it's important that, I mean, we are working with these issues. I mean, we also have to lead by example. And there are also times where we are sort of moving in a gray zone. Everything is not black or white. So I think in that sense, we do not only have to sort of crack down on things when they happen, we have to try to prevent it and also try to lead by example.
Roberto?
Just to add to that, we share similar policies. Our code of conduct is pretty strict on this. I just finalized my financial disclosure for the bank. All staff members have to disclose their assets, their investments. There's an ethics officer that reviews it. It's almost standard practice nowadays.
We've got a question coming up, but I want to just raise this broad point and then come back to the questions. We're very eager to get the questions, but I think this will help us lay a foundation and maybe generate some more thoughts on questions. I'd like you to all take a crack at the idea of what is the impact of the corruption. Cynically, you could say it's just a lot of money sloshing around and somebody gets a little richer and something like the World Bank gets a little drain on its money and, oh, well, so what? I know that's not the case. I know it really does matter. So some illustrations, and I think, Håkan, you've talked about the slum areas and the implications there. When corruption's present, how does it actually impact people?
I would like to start with a fairly sort of bold statement that corruption kills. That's how it works in developing countries in particular. And it may sound a bit dramatic, but that is really the case. So the minute you deprive someone from safe water, from basic sanitation, from possibilities of sound hygiene, etc., you will have severe impacts on people's health, for example. And we know, for example, that one of the biggest killers when it comes to child mortality is water. lack of basic sanitation, etc. So the minute that corruption deprives water of people, I mean, it basically kills. And it also leads to that people can live less healthy life. They can become less productive. So in that sense, it's really critical for poverty reduction, for continued economic growth in many countries, that corruption is one area that is looked into more, and not only it looked into, but...
It can be the difference between people getting water, clean water that's healthy, and not getting water. Corruption can just slice the flow, in effect.
It can, yeah. And I mean, corruption has many sinister logics. I mean, it can also take away incomes from the local service provider, for example. So there are quite many cases where people are not paying their water fees, for example. They are connecting around the water meter, for example. And in practice, that means that municipalities are losing revenue. They cannot maintain the water system. They cannot invest in expanding the water system.
So it's not theoretical. There's concrete evidence of how awful it is. And Peter, you see that in the big projects, the impact. What's it do?
Absolutely. The first and most obvious impact in that regard is if you look at where we how we're doing with regard to the Millennium Development Goals and how we're doing towards the targets that we've set for ourselves in this area.
How are we doing?
We're not doing in the area of water. I don't think we're doing terribly well. We're still very far from where we need to be. And Dieter was quoting this interesting work in India. If we permit corruption to raise the costs of water of delivering water and improving water supply and improving irrigation supply in today's food crisis, if we're going to permit corruption to raise those costs by 25% to 45%, and that may be conservative in some places, it's only going to extend the period of time that it's going to take us to reach those goals to have that those reasonable targets for extending water. Access to safe water and access to sanitation is, in most poor countries, the exception rather than the rule. Mm-hmm. We take it so much for granted in the developed world, and it's so rare in the developing world. And we must reverse that in the coming years. And we simply will not succeed in doing so if we do not attack corruption. It's why, to join Letitia, what Letitia said, it's why this report is so important. Shining light on corruption is the first step.
Yeah. Letitia, you want to talk about this? Impact?
I think one of the things that we don't often think about or realize is how truly complex this issue is. You know, we've just talked about, and Hakan and Peter just talked about corruption in water supply and sanitation sector. But corruption in other sectors has a major impact on water and also provides even more opportunities for corruption in water.
Can you give an example of that?
An example that one of my colleagues in GWP gave me was if you consider the country where in the power sector, in order to help farmers, they were given free electricity, okay, so that they could pump water, better water for themselves. So that led to one thing, a big problem because of over-exploitation of groundwater because they could pump more water. Mm-hmm. But then they had a lot of water, and so then they were powerful. And so then they could then sell that water, and that led to all kinds of other things.
Yeah.
And that started from a very well-intentioned act in another sector, which was to help these farmers by giving them free electricity.
Was that a mismanagement or corruption there?
Well, it started, it was not mismanagement, but it provided opportunities
for corruption. Yeah.
And ended up with mismanagement of the resource itself, which then obviously can lead to other problems because there's greater scarcity and there's fights over water and so on.
Sure, exactly. Roberto?
Let me add to what Peter just said, that I think what something that is happening, and it's basically also very well described in the report, is that in the last 15, 20 years, we've witnessed, and we're still witnesses, the transformation from a state-owned system to different forms of privatization, concessions, all the types, which not only bring all the issues of corruption that we've been talking about a few minutes ago, but also all the governance issues that are related to corruption in terms of the capacity of municipalities and local governments to manage effectively this utility. So therefore, it kind of increases the complexity and the difficulty, something that perhaps when most of the systems were created was not part of the picture.
Hydroelectricity.
In a hydropower, I would say that if corruption occurs, then most stakeholders of the project will lose, actually. Of course, in the very first place, the direct beneficiaries of the project, which in my view must include the locally affected people, must be beneficiaries at the end of the day and not victims of the project, but also the end user of electricity because of the cost increase which will result from corruption. But even the owners themselves will suffer from corruption because that will, among other things, will reduce the confidence of the lenders in lending money to those projects, and that will result in increased interest rates. And the contractors not only may suffer from penalties and penal punishment, but also their reputation is put at risk. The society at large, at the end of the day, may suffer from this because the project may simply not happen if corruption has taken place at the higher stage of the project development. And that's a tremendous missed opportunity if the project is nevertheless sustainable for the fight against climate change and providing sustainable development.
So well, great. I thought I saw a question here. This is a good time for anybody. Here's one. Yes, sir. Microphone, please. Thank you very much, Jean-Michel.
Thank you. For the panelists, how does corruption affect a country's ability to implement a sustainable water resource management policy which balances the imperatives of meeting individual basic needs, sanitation, safe drinking water, with the need to manage water resources for economic growth in the productive sectors?
Anybody wants to jump in, and we'll just go through it. Leticia?
Well, just as a start, I think you've hit the nail on the head in that one of the things that is very clear is that because of the competing uses of water, it opens itself up to huge challenges where the stronger voice will get more of the resource than it needs. The weaker voice, which probably needs the water more, will not get access to it. And there's just huge opportunities for, let's call it misbehavior in terms of water management. So you've hit the nail on the head, is that it's a very important aspect of, it's very important that we use appropriate mechanisms to help countries think strategically and make the right kinds of choices on how to balance the different uses of water in a very open and transparent way. Because if you don't do that, then you can get captured by one or other area which has more power.
How about the two bankers on that, either of you? that management question.
Well, one thing that in the World Bank we get very worried that we shine the spotlight too much on corruption issues in developing countries and sometimes fail to do so in developed countries. One thing I really liked about this is one of the most powerful stories in the report with regard to water resource management comes from Spain. And I thought this was a fabulous illustration of how very clearly corruption, especially in land use planning, corruption has led to the overgranting of housing development sites in an area of desperate water shortage, and where that overbuilding and overplanning that is on the way is going to be drawing on aquifers that feed a very sensitive biodiversity area. There's actually a UNESCO labeled area. And it's very clear. Corruption can lead to the overutilization of a water resource to the detriment of other areas where there has not been a national policy to determine that the area that that indeed the building of more houses is more important than the preservation of that particular ecosystem.
We got another example of management, poor management or governance leads to failures.
Perhaps the other way around, if I may shed some positive light. I was just reading a report issued by the bank. It's called Privatization for the Public Good, that brings in some information to the table that apparently there are also some good stories in which, particularly in the water sector, when there was the proper approach at the, let's say, at the upper scale of the whole project, taking care that the management and the policy definitions were the right ones, open, transparent, and accountable, then almost naturally, at the end of the line of the project, you'll see likely results that are consistent with this type of principles and approaches. I think one of the most important things, not only in this study by the bank, but also in TI's report, is information here is critical. The lack of information, the lack of accurate information, the lack of information that's made available, not only at the technical level in which, you know, technocrats can understand what things are going on, but basically the citizen on the street can understand what's going to happen with his or her service, how much they're going to pay for it, how quick they're going to get the connection to water, how quickly will the person that needs irrigation for their land get that irrigation. That is one, perhaps, of the biggest challenges, creating that information facility that will help all the levels of the decision-making process. And that's one of the big challenges that affects water management as a whole.
Håkan?
Yeah, what I would like to add there, I think it's been said already, is between the sectors and that there are trade-offs and basically that corruption makes it much more difficult to do proper planning, to do informed decision-making, for example. What I would like to add is that you also have this playing out within, for example, the irrigation sector. And in irrigation going to large-scale commercial farmers versus small-scale farmers, for example. So you will find far too many examples where large-scale commercial farmers are dictating when water is let on and when it's supposed to be let on and how much each farmer will get. So it's also playing out within particular sectors.
Jean-Michel, anything to add on that?
No, I think what is probably needed is to think of ways and means to solve the issue.
We'll be coming to that next. We've got a question right here. We need a microphone. Thank you very much.
I just got a question about corruption on the part of the project owner. I've been involved with four different hydro projects in three different countries. And in each of them, towards the end of the project, as the last vouchers came in, they asked, we're not paying. Well, why aren't you paying? Well, something rather general about, we think you've been doing substandard work, we think you've been corrupt. No actual proof. There's several million dollars right there, which I assume then goes to cost in future bids for that sort of behavior. Can you comment on that?
Is that when you say that you hear that this bill isn't going to be paid? You're working as a private company with
yes.
World Bank or IDB bank money?
Private company.
Working with public money.
Usually with the actual government. These are Paris state.
Yeah. So either one of the bankers must have first hand with that.
The bank has put in place several systems by which any type of complaint like the ones you're mentioning can be channeled. Either, you know, and they're quite open. You can go to the internet. There is a secure phone line in every country where the bank does operation for any type of allegation of wrongdoing. There's a whole and pre-existing system that you can bring protests and claims to the procurement process. So there are multiple doors. Some of the recent developments that we've been working on based on the experience in the cases that our office investigated is a red flags matrix for project procurement, because prevention is far better than investigation, and therefore what we start to analyze, you know, what are the trends that we find in different type of sectors of the most typical forms of corruption that appear in our projects, and what type of measures we can put in there to prevent this from happening. Perhaps we haven't done a very good job at making the aware the business community about the existence of these mechanisms, but they're out there. I think something that can be commented on this is that since the last 4 years, the five large multilateral development banks have got together and have agreed on having the same definitions on fraud and corruption in our procurement policy. So we're harmonizing most of our we have some – our procurement policies are the same. Our definitions are the same. Our grievances mechanisms are pretty much the same, and the end process is going in the same direction.
Well, I see Peter nodding, so it looks like the two of you are more or less in agreement. And I just wondered if the questioner might want to – if you want to follow up, is there anything that's unclear?
Does either bank consider these sort of events that have taken place in non-bank finance projects in its own future work with that country?
That's a very good question. And one of the criteria for the bank to investigate an allegation is whether or not our resources are involved. If our resources are not involved, we do not investigate. However, this doesn't mean that, let's say, a member country takes a decision, let's say a court investigates a case of fraud and decides there's been fraud in a given case, we obviously take that consideration into account for future deals. There's no such thing as automatic debarment or sanctioning if a bank makes a decision or if a member country makes a decision, but obviously the information doesn't go unnoticed.
We've got several questions popping up. There's a young lady here. There are several people, so let's take her first. Try to keep the questions short, and we'll give you a short answer. Fly through this, just starting to pick up. This is great. Go, fire away.
Okay, this might have been your next topic, but what I wanted to know, if corruption exists at the local levels and at the federal levels and all levels, and it's persuasive through all different sectors, is there any country out there, any governments who have taken this on, especially in the water sector, and have said, we're going to make this a priority in our country and we are going to stop these practices?
I see you smiling, Letitia, and I'll bet you know. The answer probably is, it sounds like there isn't any shining example.
I think countries at different times tackle different issues.
Yeah.
But there isn't sort of one comprehensive attack that I know of. Maybe others do.
And no country that's a model for this? No. Roberto,
maybe
you have
somebody else knows.
I just mentioned the case of Ecuador, that in a recent report from the bank appears to have some good news. However, something that also comes from the report, and I think it's very, very important, word of advice here, think twice before cut and pasting from one place to the other. This is pretty much a something that is context-related. So the conditions in which you decentralize, say, in Brazil are completely different to the conditions you decentralized in Russia. And that is something that is pretty clear coming out of the report.
Yeah, I think Hokan has the thought. On any shining example, anybody who's doing it right?
I think that we still have a long way to go before this is sort of firmly placed highly on the agendas. And I think this is only the beginning of a very long process. And I think among many international donors, for example. I mean, there has been completely unrealistic expectations of what you can do and what you can do within 3 to 4 years' time, for example. So we need to work with very long time horizons. I wouldn't say that there are any shining examples, but I think in many developing countries, work is emerging. We recently did a mapping exercise in the SADC region, Southern Africa, and it was to map ongoing activities to promote integrity, accountability, and it shows that stuff is happening, stuff is ongoing. For example, in Zambia, they have something called water watch groups, which is... it contains citizens, basically, these water watch groups, and they are looking at the relationship between service providers and the regulator.
Is this something like a neighborhood group that is doing a watch? Or
No, it's actually at the level of a town. So, for example, in Lusaka, they have these water watch groups. In Malawi, they have recently worked with sub-national water policies on
improving integrity accountability.
Well, you see somebody's doing something wrong in Lesotho, and the town and the community does what? They go to complain to the water utility, or to the they write a letter to somebody, or you know, how are they watch? How do they carry out their watch?
Yeah, I don't know if Lesotho is a good example.
Well, pick any one that you like where they're doing it.
But I could mention one example in South Africa, for example. I mean, they have established a hotline. So whenever a consumer is confronting these issues, I mean, they can call this number and then hopefully it can get resolved. Mm-hmm. I'm also involved in work in Kenya where we're trying to pilot certain mechanisms of complaints redress from consumers. So it's very much looking at the relationship between consumer and a local service provider.
And that those voices can put pressure on the system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that's the idea. Letitia, we want to get this question, but let's hear your thought and then go right over to this gentleman who's been waiting and we don't want to lose his thought.
I just wanted to say that actually, when you mentioned Lesotho, I'm not a banker, but I'm speaking about something that the bank was involved in, where there was a huge corruption case in Lesotho, $2 billion project, and they did do something right because at the end of the day, there were companies that were fined, and somebody went to jail. So there are some good things that do happen, but, you know, it's such a big issue, and it's, as you've seen, it's so complex that, you know, it's just going to take time and consistency and people working together in transparency.
At least, I mean, this report is one example of a lot of concentrated thought on this subject, so that it will be harder as we move along to ignore it, to disassociate it from any big issue. Sir.
Sigaris, I'm an attorney here in Washington. I have a question on making the international enforcement mechanisms function better. We have at least 6 anti-corruption conventions, including the UN, the OECD, 2 Council of Europe, OAS. And the question is, to what extent can the mechanisms, especially providing carrots and sticks, be used to make these conventions, which are very comprehensive, work better? For instance, the World Bank, the regional development banks mm-hmm. could develop a better carrot and stick so that they reward those countries that have mm-hmm. signed and implemented the conventions, and most of them also have a mutual evaluation procedure.
So you want to hear from the panel what is it they think could be done with the existing institutions
and also to be more intense
on the enforcement of anti-corruption.
And similarly with the national aid programs.
Yeah, okay. So is that Peter jumping into the breach?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a hugely difficult question because the question of whether a country decides or not to sign an international convention is the sovereign decision of a country, and it's not one that we as an institution would ever say to a country, you've got to sign that convention. However, we do increasingly include governance indicators, the performance on corruption, as part of the criteria through which we decide the allocation of resources for a country. Governance is the single most important indicator that a country gets with regard to our assessment of its country performance, and together with its poverty, that those are the two fundamental criteria that determine the level of resources now. So I would duck or shy away from the issue of the conventions themselves, but as what they symbolically stand for and a country's willingness to sign a convention, and more important, to ratify it and then implement it, is a fundamental input into our assessment of the government's performance.
Here's another question right here. Thank you very much. Hold on. We want to hear from Roberto.
Let me add to your question.
This is the question about the governance.
The conventions. The bank, the IDB, is actively engaged with countries in the implementation of the conventions. As Peter said, obviously we don't have the mandate to ask countries to ratify them. But once they have done so, We have a set of instruments by which we're helping countries with implementations. So far, we've done 3 or 4 technical cooperations to enhance the capacity of investigators, attorney generals, public agencies that do corruption investigation in the region to exchange best practices. We have done a meeting a year ago in Chile, just before Chile was undergoing the OECD on-site review of the first round to help them be prepared for that type of approach. We have currently 3 technical corporations approved to not only enhance the capacity of countries implementing the recommendations, particularly out of the OAS Convention, but also maybe you're aware that the UN Convention came along with a series of manuals for implementing the Convention. We're trying to translate those manuals into Spanish to be used in the region. And we are trying to incorporate the reports that come from the evaluating mechanisms as part of our dialogue with countries. So we're trying to close the cycle of the way in which, you know, trying to help countries follow their own commitments when they sign these instruments.
So they certainly see the problem, and you see they're doing something. Right here. Wait. I'm sorry. Did you get your question? No, you didn't.
Thank you.
Dizzy up here.
Just to respond to an initial question from the lady behind me, from my understanding, Colombia has the Agua Transparente program, which was launched in March by the president. It's in the initial stages of a national communication strategy.
You want to translate that phrase?
Sorry. Agua Transparente, transparent water. And from my understanding, Yemen is in the beginning stages of developing a national strategy on
Has anybody up here heard of the Agua Transparente, Transparency in Water Program. And does it seem to be taking hold, or is it another...
I have only the mention. Sorry, I did a little bit of homework before coming to this presentation about the different initiatives, and it was part of the list that was provided to me by the water sector, which is not my sector. But
so
yes,
I guess as we move along, we'll see if it works.
I have a question, if I may, as well. It's been noted that the corruption, due to its clandestine nature and also due to the different contexts in different countries, is a unique challenge in each country. So for project managers and for task managers who come up with their own devices to address this, one of the issues that I think we're struggling with is how do we monitor the impact of anti-corruption mechanisms or even at the larger level, strategies? Any words of advice on that level? Thank you.
Who wants? Oh, Håkan looks like he's ready to go.
Sure, but I think it's a challenging question, and I don't have a good answer, perhaps. But I think it's absolutely important to do that, to be able to know, are we doing the right things, for example. And I think there it's and what some of the research is saying, for example, is that in places where corruption is very rampant, where it's not the exception but the norm, it perhaps makes more sense to apply sort of very broad governance reform, for example. And that would be quite difficult to measure, for example. What I think one can measure perhaps a bit more easily is local-level examples. I was mentioning some examples before that if you have very confined geographical areas, and if you're looking at the relation between local service providers and consumers, for example, I think you can fairly easily do that type of assessment. How many more people got access to water, for example, because that is the ultimate thing.
Let's. I know everyone would have a quick
30
thought
second
here
on
from
that.
Peter.
Just,
yeah,
I think it's one of. Fortunately, I think it's one of the most monitorable areas in which we operate. Access. Quality, cost. Mm-hmm. 3 absolutely independently verifiable indicators in this sector that have 3 of the areas where we have the most difficulty. We have poor access, we have low quality water, and we have very, very high cost of bringing that water as a consequence of corruption. And that you can monitor.
Okay. Leticia?
Just 30 seconds also is that there's another aspect. Because this is so complex and there's so many different interests, bringing people together, bringing the different stakeholders together and getting people to understand the different roles and responsibilities and what everybody's doing is another way to help people to see areas where you can focus to make sure that things are being done right. So getting people around the table who have a particular interest in that, you know, in the subject is crucial, because then they can express their voice and get a better sense
right.
of
what needs to be done.
Fantastic. Okay, here we are. Please.
Just adding a little bit to the complexity, because I think it was Roberto who mentioned Ecuador, and I just want to sort of, if you're not aware of it, remind you that there's actually a complaint pending in the CAO, a guarantee that was given by the World Bank in the Guayaquil case. So, I mean, it's difficult probably to pull out any country.
So, a question?
Yeah, sort of a question, a comment. For Håkan, he talked about the self-connection as a form of corruption. I'm just wondering sort of how do you really break that? Because oftentimes when I've worked, for example, in South Africa, where you see a lot of self-connections, it's oftentimes due to disconnections, due to corruption in the water sector itself. So where do you really cut it? What's corruption and the people's need for actually getting access to that? And then a quick question to Peter Harold, because you mentioned...
Well, could you let the first question come back with an answer? So we... Yeah, go ahead.
No,
we'll come right back.
Yeah, I think your question is showing the paradox, because at the same time, people are engaging in corruption because they don't have a choice, basically. So I think in terms of working with poverty reduction, I mean, one has to be very, very sensitive, because we don't want to deprive people from their access to water, for example. And we know that in quite many cases, it's also due to paying bribes or connect illegally to the water system, for example. So I think that is just showing the complexity of the whole issue and something that really needs to be taken into account as well.
Well, I want to temporarily go back on my promise to you. There's a man here who's been waiting now for about 10 minutes, and I keep missing him. So don't leave. Keep the microphone. We'll come back to you. But let's give the microphone to this gentleman. And then there's a woman back there and another gentleman. The microphone over here. This is the long-suffering questioner. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. All right. It's actually in relation to what Peter said earlier about being able to look at not being able to force the different countries to sign anything. But then you do have, you know, the inconvenient truth that there is water going through different countries. And you have, you know, say a river that is utilized by several countries, but then, you know, as supply or demand, you know, increases, who decides, you know, which country, like how much of the, you know, river water should go into the next country?
Okay, that's the question right there. Peter, Letitia, one of you, I know you're jumping at it.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the question was, but
it's something to do with the management of water as it flows through your country.
What's the ultimate? I mean, like how, you know, once things get to a certain point, you say, you know, okay, well, this country isn't going to sign on, but this country will, you know, actually negotiate. But they're the ones in control. So ultimately, right. It becomes, you know, how, you know, this is either going to go to war or right. It's going to go to death.
Right.
I mean, those are the two things that's going to happen.
Okay, in that case, we have that one of our safeguards, in fact, is. It governs international. What do we call it?
International borders.
International borders. That's what we call it. Okay, it's simple enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, a good example. What is between India and Pakistan, where we actually act as an arbiter in the amount of water that can be taken from the rivers that flow between those two countries that tend to have disputes between them. So that is an area where we have no reticence in intervening in the question of waters which cross boundaries.
Botswana is another place where that will arise. The Botswana waterway affecting Zambia
Right. And indeed, we will not if there is an operation which affects the flow of water from one country to another. We will not proceed with that operation until the other country. Has given its concurrence to that first action.
Okay, here, let's take this question.
Yeah, no objection.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's for Peter Hale because he mentioned the problem with just three bidders in when you were in Ghana. And I know of many cases where there's been World Bank, or at least several cases in World Bank projects where there's been just one bidder because for some reason some bidders have withdrawn. And you mentioned, and I agree with you, there's a problem even if there's three. But what are you doing in order to have more bidders in the procurement process?
Okay. We're really running out of time, but these are great questions. We're going to get three more questions in 2 more minutes. So
very
short. Yes, please.
The short answer is to try to analyze those markets first and break things down into smaller bites so that there can be a greater participation in each procurement process is the simple sense.
Oh, great. Okay, there's the lady, also been waiting a long time. She's on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for your thoughtful comments and TI for this great report. My name is Sue Ringler, and I work for a company called ITT Corporation. We do a lot of work in the water sector in India and China. We don't work on bank finance projects, but we're in the private sector and obviously have to deal with corruption issues all the time. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are as to what kind of partnerships or how the private sector that's very involved in the water industry can work more with the public sector. You know,
all
obviously,
right. How about that?
Well,
right there.
The people on the ground know who the people are in the government that are behaving corruptly. And there comes a point in time where there has to be someone to confront and try and change what's going on in government.
You mean
and
that
I'm wondering
it,
what
it
your
might
thought.
Be occurring in plain sight? Is that kind of
it's
the idea?
It's always occurring in plain sight because the people on the ground know who the bad actors are.
So what to do
are.
About that? Hokan.
Excellent. This question came up and sort of what can we do? What can be done? And I think there are a number of things we can do within the water sector itself and working sort of more vertically on these issues. I'm engaged in Water Integrity Network, and it's a global network and aiming at building broad coalitions to promote integrity accountability and to build a sort of better political momentum on these issues. We're also promoting awareness, advocacy. We're also supporting very practical action on the ground. So I think a network like WIN provides a very good opportunity to be able to work with different types of partners, private sector, civil society, governments, university experts, etc. I should mention that we also have the program manager here for WIN, and we will, of course, be available after the discussions here. We can talk more about
and
about
please do. Please come up, and let's keep this going after. Some of the panelists have to leave. So I'm going to just catch a couple more quick questions. Make them bullet questions, yours, please. And then, and Roberto, if you can hold it just till we get this question. I'm sorry. Yeah.
My name is Deki, and my question is related to water resource management and armed conflict. What kind of policy advice would you provide to country possessing numerous water resources, such as the Congo, but which are prone to armed conflict?
Leticia.
I don't know. I mean, that's a difficult one. Congo has many resources, and I mean, you're putting together two major things. You're talking about armed conflicts and water resources, and I'm not quite sure what sort of a link you're trying to make. Improved?
Yes.
Oh, how to improve water resource management when you're in conflict?
In the midst of a conflict, as in Congo. So.
Wow.
How to improve anything?
How to improve anything? I mean, it's a big issue, and of course, everybody you want to be able to make the best use of the resource. What I would say is to find a forum within which you can get the different stakeholders of the resource together around the table to talk about how best to use it, how best to manage it, how best to make sure that everybody plays their part. How easily you can do that within an environment of conflict, it's hard to say. But those resources, I mean, the rivers and waters in the Congo are also shared with other countries. And it comes back to your question about sharing. There are many international river basin organizations that work to look for opportunities to share water for the common good.
Jean-Michel has a quick thought. Thanks.
Just a quick thought that some projects and hydropower projects in particular can be a source of peace. There is one chapter of the World Commission on Dams report which is entitled Sharing Water for Peace.
Fantastic.
And there are several examples of that in which when such projects were constructed and involved, in fact, solidarity between different countries, transboundary projects, it was absolutely proven that it was a factor of peace.
Roberto has a...
I would like to go back to Sue's question. The fourth component of the water and sanitation strategy of the bank has to do with efficient and transparent utilities. And one of the things we're trying to do is see if we can pair suppliers and from the private and the public sector to raise the standards of all operators in the system. So that's very much into our radar screen. Later on, I can show you the way in which we try to approach this. But a special fund is going to support the way in which companies can exchange their best practices so we raise the level.
And if you want to hear more on this, Roberto, could you wait a few minutes and talk to people if they want to? Here's a question from this lady. Thank you.
Maria Gonzalez from the World Bank. I just want to say that together with WIN and Transparency International, we have a capacity building program at the local level, and we are trying to work with different stakeholders, the private sector, the civil society, the government, in trying to identify the gaps. They identify the gaps and challenges to combat corruption in the mm-hmm. water sector, and some initiatives that are creating a framework for combating corruption in all the countries that we are working on. Is great to share with you some of the initiatives like Agua Tuya, like Agua Transparente, yeah. and others.
Okay, so and I suppose you'll be around.
Have more information in the webpage, but also there outside.
And would you be around and people can talk with you? That's a good idea. Here's the man in the back in the light blue shirt.
Question about sanitation, which has barely been broached here. Are the corruption challenges in the sanitation sector similar to those or different from those in the water sector?
Aren't they mixed? Isn't it a big issue of sanitation in water? Are you talking about something separate?
I think the panel will understand.
Well, I'd like to understand it.
There are two different sectors, water and sanitation.
Yeah.
2.5 billion people around the world don't have access to sanitation.
Right. So do you relate it to our water?
Are the issues in water the same as, are the corruption issues in sanitation the same as in water, or are they different?
Fantastic. Peter.
Yeah, I mean they're pretty similar, but just by the difference of current access, as you know, there's been far less attention to sanitation and far fewer programs. Large numbers of countries simply don't have sanitation programs at all, except in the capital city.
So, Leticia, what do you say?
I would say that they're exactly the same if you're building sewers and so on, because it's big contracts and so on. However, the main point is that we haven't dealt with sanitation the way we should have, and so we haven't paid as much attention to the sanitation.
Here comes Roberto.
Your question is very important, and I think there are similarities and differences. Perhaps some of the differences are particularly related to the type of activity that is connected to sanitation that is different from others. We conducted a review of all the cases our office investigated, and we started finding what were the common patterns in some of the sectors and what were the different patterns in some of the sectors. And one of the lessons we've learned so far is, for example, that in general, in an infrastructure project, you will find certain types of fraud that are more prevalent than in other sectors that have to do with the way in which suppliers or constructors or builders provide certain type of information that is completely particular to that type of activity. And it's different from constructing a road or building a hospital or delivering a service such as a consultant service. So one lesson that we're learning is, and your question is very relevant, that you have to pay particular attention to the type of activity before making any kind of assessment of what type of corruption you're talking about. So I think you touch a very important point. You have to focus on the specifics here.
Håkan wants to get in a word.
I think that, sanitation may or may not involve water. I mean, there are many different types of technologies when it comes to sanitation, various types of dry sanitation, ecological sanitation technologies, for example, which may not be very prone to corruption at all, for example, because then you're focusing more on the very local solutions, very small-scale solutions, for example. So maybe by focusing more on that type of solutions, you can perhaps reduce corruption by design, basically by avoiding these sort of huge, very complex contracts, for example. So that could be one type of impact of going for these types of small-scale solutions.
We have three questions back here, and there's this gentleman with his hand up right here. He's been on hold for quite a while, and then we'll get back just back in that sector. We'll get some more, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Joe Ford. I work for the U.S. EPA. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia in 1995. I had the fortune to visit South Africa, and I met an engineering firm that was installing a small water supply system in a small village outside Pietermaritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal province, and what I observed was very interesting. They were putting piped water in this little village, and they were installing a water meter for each house. And my obvious question is, how are they going to pay for it? And their obvious answer was, we don't know, because a lot of these people don't have jobs. So then the corruption starts at the lowest level, because when the water meter guy comes next month, they're probably going to have to bribe the guy with a chicken or something, because just so they don't shut their water. Now, this is corruption. This starts at the lowest level. The engineering firm made a big chunk of money because the South African government paid them. But the failure is at the bottom. They're basically providing this village a good that they cannot afford, forcing them to pay for it, and then they get then the bribes start right away.
Well, let's see what the comments are.
Yeah, how do you address that?
Okay.
Sorry, I want to jump in. I don't agree. The failure is at the top. They shouldn't have put in water meters in that kind of an environment. They should have looked at what was the best solution for that environment rather than to put in something that perhaps not as appropriate.
Well, what they told me is that the government was stopping the philosophy of providing free water. They didn't want to do that anymore because...
You can provide water without putting in water meters. There are technologies and solutions out there.
There would be a way to put charge for the water without the metering. And so this is a waste of money to install those meters, in a sense. Is that it? That's a form of potential corruption?
I was just commenting on the fact that I think that the failure was at the top, not necessarily at the bottom. They had no choice. They had to provide the chicken or whatever to pay for it. And if they had been given a service that was sustainable, it would have been a different situation.
So it looks like a program that had a corruption incentive built into it, which is pretty terrible.
When it comes to community, supplying communities, especially small communities with water, I think we have some of the best stories in development. Letitia and I have seen a lot of our happiest experiences are when we've witnessed that. And it doesn't work when the solution is we and the government are going to come and tell you what you need. And it does work, and it works spectacularly when the community is mobilized and the community is in charge. And one of the lessons from this data, I think, is participation as the solution. Had this particular water supply started from mobilizing this community and letting them design, first of all, where it was going to be and how it was going to be located and how they were going to collect resources from amongst themselves, design the system according to what they knew they could afford sustainably, then they might have had a very different result.
There you go. Okay. Another question here, sir.
From the Georgetown University Law Center. I would like to ask, do the private companies or even the international banks provide whistleblowers protection? And is the
World Bank
whistleblowers protection?
Sorry.
And does the World Bank have any experience about the claiming immunity protection when some of their employers are involved in any corruption?
I think Peter has that answer. You've had experience with that, haven't you?
I've had some personal experience. Firstly, on the whistleblower, we just enhanced our whistleblower policy, and we have very similar whistleblower policies amongst all of the multilateral development banks now, and it's very important. You don't now? You don't? Oh, well, we'll...
Meaning you don't have one?
We do have... I'm sorry, we do have one. Why don't you finish up?
Okay, I'll give you a copy of the new one, Robert.
I got it.
When I was director in Ghana, I had a lot of personal experience of the corruption issue and the danger to which we can be placed. That I discovered some rather large scale corruption in the water sector, and alerted the government we would withdraw our support if they proceeded with this particular corrupt contract, and they did proceed. I then withdrew our support, and this became very public, and I was subject to an awful lot of threats and pressures, and the bank was very clear in its support for me in this process. And fortunately, it had a happy ending, and the uh, the government changed its mind and did proceed in a much more transparent way. But it is a thing we absolutely insist on. It's
and
very important.
Roberto, IDB on whistleblowers? Now,
we do have a whistleblower protection policy, but it only covers our staff. For very practical reasons, the bank cannot commit to protect the rest of the world. It would be promising something that we can't deliver. So it does cover our staff.
African Bank, by the way, does have a whistleblower policy. It's very aggressive.
The UN also has a more expansive policy, but then you come to practical issues. Okay.
So I think there's one final question out there. I think my questioner might have given up. That's it? Anybody here? We're a little over time. I think it's been very exciting. We're about to... this is the 1, 2, 3. This is the end of the auction, the end of the story. I think they've done a great job, and I hope you give them a great round of applause.